Hello, friends. Today is the 25th of September, 2013, and we are working on a new section. It is an extensive section from esoteric psychology, and it is what we call the Laws of the Soul webinar commentaries, with this abbreviation right here. And we have done the introduction so far, and I stopped at the law of sacrifice, which is the very first and foundational law of the seven laws of group life. So let us undertake this work together and see what we discover in terms of the new set of laws by which we must live when we are transiting out of identification with the personality into identification as the soul. The section upon which we now enter in our studies will be difficult and controversial. I can attest to that. So many disciples abhor the idea of sacrifice. Actually, it is true. It's quite amazing. But they do. We do. There's something in us that does not want to give up our prerogatives as personalities. The thread which will guide us out of the bewildering maze of thought into which we must perforce enter, you can understand DK's service here, guiding us through this maze, because he has the acuity to do it, is the golden one of group love. This will be always found as the key to all of these laws, the ever-present key to these laws. Group understanding, group relations, and group conduct. These are indeed the laws of group life, and that is the way they were discussed in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, where this section, like so many anticipatory sections, was first undertaken. It's quite astonishing how many seeds Master DK planted in this large book written for initiates, and then he unfolded them, the white magic seed, the esoteric astrological seed, the esoteric psychological seed. Was there anything on healing? Well, there certainly was plenty on initiation. The unfoldments came later in larger books than the original presentation of the subject in Cosmic Fire, and books in which he spoke more to the disciple at our level of understanding than to the initiate, per se. So the esoteric name here of this law, the law of sacrifice, that's the exoteric name, excuse me. Esoteric name, the law of those who choose to die. We see the element of Saturn, of Libra, involved here, the symbol of rosy cross with a golden bird, the sixth ray energy has been involved in the rose color. The golden bird is the soul, and the golden bird is, I think, above the rosy cross. I think what we have to do is find that particular tabulation in which all of these are listed. Yes, so actually here we have a fuller elaboration, a little bit more about the symbol here. It says a rosy cross with a bird hovering above it. So, and it simply says here a rosy cross with a golden bird. So it's a golden bird hovering above it. And the life has become a rosy cross. The quality of white, of synthesis, of inclusiveness of all colors has been added to the red of desire, and the result has been the creation of the color rose, which is the indicates the transmutation of the astral body rather than its addiction to the Martian color red. So a new type of aspiration is now included in the life, and it leaves the lower worlds of form behind, and this is called the outpouring, fourth ray at wanting factor. Okay, let's see, right here we are. The outpouring fourth ray at wanting factor, the fourth ray is the ray of at-one-ment, and here we have a very externalizing type of energy which can reconcile the opposites and bring them into unity. Of course, there will necessarily be a sacrifice when this is done, because the pairs of opposites do pull naturally in opposite directions, and one will have to leave the identification with the lower of the pairs of opposites and embrace the higher. There will be a rending process involved here, and eventually the two will be united by the one who stands steadfast at the midway point. So one has to endure this rending process and has to leave behind, at least temporarily, the lower of the pairs of opposites until it is redeemed, in favor of including the higher of the pairs of opposites. So once the emotional nature is transmuted, once we have begun to give up our addiction to matter, form, the beautiful color rose characterizes the nature. We become a brother of the rosy cross. Eventually we overturn that cross of sacrifice and emerge into the radiance of full life, as we are told in one of the old commentaries, the cross is overturned. Maybe I can find that for us. I think it's important. The cross is overturned. Well, there's a couple of them. And out into the radiant life and light. The cave is left behind, the cross is overturned, the way stands clear, the word sounds clear within the head and not within the heart. Enter again the playground of the Lord, and this time lead the games. Well, he's gone through that long and narrow tunnel. Here it is, far off, and he has to pass through this difficult cave before the crucifixion. Into the dark, the life proceeds. The life is the pilgrim, the monad in extension as the jiva. Into the dark, the life proceeds. A different voice seems to sound forth. Enter the cave and find your own. Walk in the dark, and on your head carry a lighted lamp. The cave is dark and lonely. Cold it is in a place of many sounds and voices. The clear cold light. The substance is turning cold. We are no longer heated. We no longer have the power to heat the substance into a state of excitation. Rather, we are cold to it, and it relapses into a cold state, which allows us to concentrate within our soul nature and not be distracted by the Martian heat of substance. The voices of the many sons of God left playing on the playground of the Lord make their appeal for light. Well, that's on the green field. We'll have to go over this sometime. It's a marvelous stanza. The cave is long and narrow. It takes a while to make the passage. The air is full of fog. There are still glamours here. There are still misperceptions. We are still subject to all the illusions and glamours which present themselves and finally before the cross is overturned. The sound of running water meets the rushing sound of wind and the frequent roll of thunder. Well, it's a long cave, and it's on the path of initiation, really. Far off and dim and most vaguely seen, appears an oval opening, its color blue. The blue of the second ray and into the world of soul, promising entry into the kingdom of the souls. Stretched athwart this space of blue, a rosy cross is seen, and at the center of the rose, where four arms meet, a rose. Upon the upper limb, a vibrant diamond shines within a five-pointed star. And this is the promise of liberation into mastership once the cross is overturned. We pass through, we ourselves are the cross, and we transit through that stage, owning the empty nail-marked hands which can no longer grasp for ourselves. We will explore these commentaries. They are marvelous, and we want to have a better idea about some of the symbology here. But anyway, the rosy cross is involved in this sacrifice, and when we enter the stage of crucifixion, we are in a stage of sacrifice of all that has been familiar in the three lower worlds, and all that has pertained in a way to the number four as it relates to matter, or to the four lower elemental groups. We can say the mental elementals, astral, etheric, and dense physical elementals. And the one day the golden bird will fly free, liberated, really, having the quality of the solar angels after the fourth initiation. The path of sacrifice leads all, it's foundational, and it leads all the way to the fourth initiation. So it's outpouring upon every true aspirant and disciple who has caught the vision, and who it's the energy of yoga in a way, it's the at-oneing energy, and who seeks at-one-ment with the higher of the pairs of opposites which he has at first dimly been able to envision or touch. And then there is the relinquishment of all that has hitherto held him, but then the reclaiming of that lower field once there is polarization within the higher. We are shifting our polarization, really, as we operate according to the law of sacrifice. Our point of tension is ever rising, and the worlds which we contain are becoming higher and lower at the same time. So we choose to die from the worlds of form which had captivated us and with which we were enthralled, which really means to be imprisoned. And we enter the focus within the sacrifice petals of the soul, that focus being a willing, loving sacrifice at all times for the sake of, you know, group love, group understanding, group relations, and group conduct. Let's just see here. I think we should just list these because they are so important. Group love, group understanding, group relations, and group conduct. These four are the touchstone to the rules laws of the soul, which we are now considering. Okay. And he promises us that it will be difficult, and we will be entering a bewildering maze of thought, and also there will be controversy about it, differences of opinion. I've taught this section a number of times in the esoteric psychology classes of the University of the Seven Rays, and it's amazing to me to watch the students try to redefine sacrifice so that no pain is left in it, so that the implications of what sacrifice really means to the form are somehow overlooked, and we escape with gentle platitudes about sacrifice means to make sacred, as if that making sacred involved no relinquishment, no detachment, no rending, no pain. It is the nature of the fourth kingdom, the human kingdom, to avoid pain at all costs, really, I think. it is our particular bias, so to speak, a hatred of causing pain amounting to moral cowardice, as we are told, one of the liabilities of the fourth ray. So that liability extends to the fourth kingdom as well. The law of sacrifice, which is the first of the laws to be grasped by human intelligence, the higher laws are perhaps more difficult to grasp, and is therefore the easiest for man to understand, though I haven't really seen that that is the case, to tell you the truth, because he is already governed by it and therefore aware of it. Well, let's just say he is forced to sacrifice in every sacrifice petal, which is the third of each tier. So there's quite an unconscious sacrifice going on in the third petal, rather more conscious in the sixth than completely conscious sacrifice in the ninth petal, which gives to the probationary initiate the third initiation. Even in relation to the eighth petal, we are told the utter sacrifice of all forever. So this is easiest, he says, because we are already, and I want to say perforce, governed by it. We have no say in the matter. The conditions on our planet, the symbol of which is the cross encircled, force us into sacrificial conditions so we can become true adjudicators between the pairs of opposites and leave behind the remnants of the previous solar system with which we are still identified and which we have to rip ourselves away from, detach from, and in that disengagement from the energies and forms of the previous solar system comes what we call sacrifice, because we are giving up our identification and our engagement with a dimension of life which needs to be outgrown and probably should have been outgrown long before this, were it not for the what we have learned is the failure of our planetary logos on the moon chain, and therefore the failure of all of us. And I'm sure some of us were there. Anyway, we are already governed by it. This law came to its first major expression. Now, not that it wasn't expressed before that, because the very nature of our planet demands it, during the slowly disappearing, since 1625, age. The present age, the Piscean Age. So, since 1625, and check Esoteric Psychology 1, page 26. This law has always been functioning and active in the world. It really is the substitution. Well, you know, different things occur to me here, but I would say the painful substitution of the greater for the lesser. Of course, we're attracted to the lesser for a long time. There are people who have been in prison for a long time, and when maybe after 30 or 40 years they're offered their freedom, they commit a crime in order to get right back in to what they are used to. That for them has become their home, and they are afraid of the greater outer world. So they like the confinement, and it often is the case with human beings in general. So it has been functioning and active in the world. Our particular planet is the scene whereon the energies of the previous solar system particularly are being redeemed and transformed into a vibration which accords with the intended vibration of this second solar system. And this is, so we live on a planet of transmutation, where there's an elevation of ancient vibration until it accords with the intended present vibration. In a way, we're not even alive when we're working within these three lower worlds, which are vestigial in a certain respect. So this law has always been functioning and active in our world anyway, for it is one of the first of the inner subjective laws. That's what we're studying here, the inner subjective laws, not the laws of nature per se, to express itself consciously and as an active ideal in human life. In other words, humanity began striving for sacrifice very much under the teaching of the Christ. And maybe, of course, before this was the case with those who understood what initiation was, but on such a wide scale, it was not the case. The theme of all the world religions has been divine sacrifice, the immolation of the cosmic deity through the process of universal creation, and of the world saviors by their death and sacrifice as a means of salvation and eventual liberation. So many world religions have had this, but perhaps never so focally as in the Christian dispensation, due to the monumental efforts of the head of the hierarchy, the Christ, to bring this way of release to the masses of men, masses of human beings, and now millions upon millions, billions, in fact, upon our planet, embrace to a greater or lesser extent this will to sacrifice, this ideal of sacrifice as a desirable type of behavior leading to a desirable goal. Because the great Lord, the Christ, set the example for all of us. I guess as we go along, we'll realize in greater depth always what a tremendous world teacher he has been and is. There are teachers along all the different rays, but the major ray is the second in our solar system, and even in terms of the emerging second ray soul of our planet. And so he has exemplified the expression of that ray for us within the three lower worlds, which are so attractive out of habit to the human consciousness. So we've had a number of these world saviors, and usually the process is the same. My friend and colleague Robert Burrell has done some marvelous videotapes. Video programs on the New World Religion, and he has shown the parallelism in the life of a number of the saviors who are representative of the various religions, world religions, and how through their sacrifice redemption did occur. I think the Christ is simply the epitome of that tendency which has been operative for millions of years. So in order to bind ourselves again to divinity, which is the meaning really of religare, religion, sacrifice is required. Relinquishment of the past in favor of an uncertain but highly desirable future sensed as much through faith as through experience. Well, really sensed more through faith, because the experience is not there. But those who do the will of God shall know, and we have to submit ourselves to the sacrifice in order to know of its benefits. So the idea has been with us a long time, but now at the time of the emergence of the second ray soul of our planetary logos, there is a great importance for humanity to understand the value of the law of sacrifice and its elevatory potentials. Really, without the sacrifice, there is no spiritual progress. Such is the blindness and such is the contaminating influence of the lower separative mind, the egoistic mind, that this divine law of sacrifice is wielded with the selfish intent of personal and individual salvation. It's still, what should we say, its application for many remains egocentric. And the sacrifice is accomplished, or sacrifice is pursued for one's own sake and not for the sake of others. But the travestied truth remains the unsullied truth on its own plane, which we assume must be at least the plane of the soul, at least. And this dominant world law governs the appearing and disappearing of universes. It all depends what he means by universe. Does he mean a galaxy or the universal entirety? There's quite a philosophical question there about whether each universe comes into expression on the basis of a law of sacrifice. That could be explored, because, after all, what is there remaining to redeem? And sacrifice is a redemptive law. The law of sacrifice is redemptive. After a final universal pralaya, is there anything left to redeem, or is not all gathered into the absolute on a completely equal basis, with no remnants requiring redemption? But if the word universe means something smaller, then always there will be energies and forms left behind the varying ingathering syntheses, and they will be expelled from those syntheses because they were unworthy of absorption. Then in that case, the reappearing of a universe, meaning a lesser whole, could be for the sake of those units that were left expelled. But the travestied truth, which is selfish and egocentric, intent on one's own salvation, that, you know, you think about the flagellants, and they whip themselves to mortify the flesh for their own salvation. What good could whipping oneself do for others, you know? When a man climbed on a pillar and stayed there with his arm outstretched for years and years and years until his arm froze and withered in its place, he may have mortified the flesh, but what good would it do for a larger group? What was his motive? I think it was still very self-centered. It's harder oftentimes to live for others than it is to mortify oneself for them, or even to die for them. But the travesty truth remains the unsullied truth on its own plane, and this dominant world law. Okay, and we see this happening all the time now. involuntary sacrifice for the most part, and increasingly voluntary as the stage of initiation increases. This dominant world law governs the appearing and disappearing of universes, of solar systems, of races, and of nations, of world leaders and world rulers, of incarnating human beings, and of revealing sons of God. In other words, why reappear? And we say, for the sake of those left behind and their redemption, which means inclusion into the glorious synthesis. But, you know, that's the question. One day maybe I'll have the onerous task of debating this with HPB sometime. She says, Pralaya enters and everything is as it is, even in a state of incompletion. But one wonders regarding the universal Pralaya, of which there have been countless, if one must count in time, whether those Pralayas have ever left anything behind at all, because there is no outside to the Absolute. Everything has to be absorbed within it at the final universal Pralaya, so it looks to me like a universal redemption with nothing left behind. So I think of the emergence of a new universe as a great creative potential. The emergence of the universe is a great creative potential. And a great act of joyous creativity, rather than as necessarily a redemptive act, because there has to be something to redeem. Okay. Now let's move on. I'm just pondering these things, you see. Maybe when we read normally, we read quickly, and we do not read in depth or ponderously. Here, I suppose we're proceeding in a rather ponderous manner. Let us see if we can interpret or define the true significance of this law, which is in reality the expression of a divine impulse, leading to a defined activity with its consequent subsequent results and effects. So the main thing to gather out of this is that sacrifice is divine and divinely impulsed. It was this aspect of sacrifice which led to the creation of the worlds and to the manifestation of the divine Creator, and maybe here we are speaking more locally of our planetary logos and solar logos, perhaps. Well, friends, I think I'm having a little bit of a difficult time here, because apparently I did not really record all that. Oh my, I thought for sure that I had. So I have to begin back here a little bit and hope that there's not too much overlap. This is the impulse of giving, the law of sacrifice. And the Christ said, it is better to give than to receive. The amazing thing is that the abundance of life and all of its riches and qualities comes to those who give. Every master knows then that to those who give all is given. This is the fundamental law, and the masters are those precisely who have given all that may be given within the three lower worlds and have therefore been elevated into the higher worlds. This impulse of giving comes from the soul and from our focus as a soul upon the higher mental plane. It is not a lunar impulse. It does not come from our unconscious, retrogressive nature which has to be redeemed. It is a selfless impulse. And it comes from those who recognize that the self of others is their own very self. The whole secret of the doctrines of the forgiveness of sins and the at-one-ment lie behind this simple phrase. I think that we forgive when we understand the identity of ourselves with others. It is the oneself forgiving the oneself, an aspect of the oneself forgiving another aspect of the same self. In other words, as we really, forgive others, we are forgiving ourselves simultaneously. So through our giving comes the forgiveness of sins. The soul is, some people have emphasized this kind of play on words. The soul is for giving, or the soul is for the purpose of giving, or the spirit within us loves nothing more than to give itself until all become itself. It is the giving of everything that we have which inclines others to rise into the realization that they are the very self from out of which we are giving. So through the giving comes the forgiveness of our sins. We also realize the impermanent nature of sin and the fact that sin is the briefest of states compared to the glory of eternal life. It is a passing stage of ignorance and the activities coming from that ignorance, which can be, this stage can be dissolved by the outpouring of divine love. I, if I be lifted up, will draw all men unto me. I'm reminded of the conversion of, was it in Les Miserables, Jean Valjean? You know, he had gotten out of prison and he was a great cynic about the evils of human nature, and he was given a little refuge by a kindly priest, and he stole the silver candlestick. It was one of a pair. He stole it, and he ran away. He figured he'd sell it, and he would get a start because he had no money. But the authorities caught him. You probably know this because you've seen now, I think, maybe the movie, some of you. The authorities caught him, and he was going to be thrown back in prison. But the priest said, "Ah, my son, why did you not take the other? I gave you both." It was a lie. But it was a redemptive lie, and Valjean was so overcome by the forgiveness, the givingness of the priest, that his life changed ever afterwards from that point, and he became a man for giving, and a great, positive force within his community. He was always pursued by his shadow, Jobert, who could not understand forgiveness, and when he himself was forgiven by Valjean in a very powerful way, he couldn't take it in. He committed suicide. He could not grasp the possibility of such forgiveness. So when we forgive others, there are no others really to forgive. One is forgiving the ignorance of the oneself in a state of emanation which is immersed in ignorance, in density. And by that very act of not punishing, but of declaring a faith in the internal self of the one to be forgiven, that internal self rises closer to a state of identification with the one self. I mean, you know, as I somewhat joked to myself, you know, why worry about losing anything? We've already lost or become detached from infinitudinous universes, you know. Where is universe 10 in the series of universes? I can't count from the beginningless beginning, but you can count from the present 10 backwards. Do you remember anything? You've lost it all. You've given it all up. Are you grasping onto the values of that particular universe and all the things you held dear when you were an immersion within that universe? Hardly. You know, we've had loss after loss after loss. So when you look at a slight expression of ignorance in a fellow emanation, we have to realize its very passing nature, and that everyone who appears to be ignorant now in his emanated state is a graduate of the glory of infinitudinous universes. If you look at anything, you find everything. If you look at anyone, you find everyone. So who is it that is in this state of this state of ignorant sin at the moment? It's one who has been gloriously released ever and ever and ever, infinitudinously. So we have to have deep respect for those who are mired in sin, because who are they anyway? They're the one self in a rather dense state of emanation and waiting for retraction, and the outpouring energy of the fourth ray, in this case, you know, in a way drawing up the lower of the pairs of opposites, I, if I be lifted up, will draw all men unto me. That is what lifts up these immersed emanations to reclaim their own true identity. Well, you know, it's one thing to talk about it, and, you know, when the sin committed touches you, and you feel offended by it and hurt by it and all that, it's difficult to enter the philosophical mode and to see things more as they really are and to say, okay, this is the self acting in ignorance, but you are the graduate, you know. You are the successful released consciousness of infinitudinous universes. What have I to hold against you? The you I think I'm talking to doesn't even exist. It's just a perception, the one being who is ever perfect and sinless is what exists. So will I outpour this energy which says, I believe in you, I affirm the being in you, I give you my recognition of your true being, which is sinless, and in that giving may you rise into that state? Do we do that, or do we just say, I have a grudge, I'm going to hold this against you, I will seek my revenge? It takes a long time to outgrow the tendency towards revenge, because the revenging one does not realize that the one upon whom he is wreaking vengeance is him, is his very self. So the whole secret of the doctrines of the forgiveness of sins and the at-one-ment lie hid in this simple phrase, which I think I should put in purple. The impulse of giving. It is the basis of the Christian doctrine of love and sacrifice. We can say that as we relinquish attachment to the third aspect of divinity, we, through forgiveness, we rise into the field of the second aspect of divinity and live by its laws, the laws of the soul. Hence the emphasis laid in the Piscean Age and through the influence of Christianity upon just these two things, forgiveness and atonement. You know, sometimes it's spelled like atonement, but by now we should realize when the apparent word atonement is written, we have to think of it as at one meant. And our forgiving attitude brings about atonement in the one forgiven and in ourselves. So our forgiving attitude brings about atonement in the one forgiven and in ourselves. Forgiveness is the affirmation of the, what can we call it, the incomparable majesty of the Spirit within, the unconquerability of the Spirit, the stainlessness of the Spirit. And when that is affirmed in others, they have the power then to overcome their egoism and all of the expressions of lower activity to which that egoism leads. So we are affirming, we are giving, in forgiving, we are giving an affirmation of the Spirit. So in forgiving, we affirm the Spirit and strengthen its power over attachment to lower life, and that is what love does. When you love someone, you say, I see something in you that is perfect, ever eternally lovable. I affirm that, and you can affirm that, and you can rise above all of your sins. What did the Christ say? Something to this effect, that if your sins, even if your sins be as black as night, I will wash them clean. Something to that effect. You know, you can be involved in the deepest type of sin. You are the Spirit, and redemption is always possible, even to those who have journeyed so far into the land of distances as to be members of the Black Lodge. In the end, there has to be universal redemption. As I think about it, it seems to have happened all the time. Nothing left after the universal pralaya is how I say it to myself, and no continuation of progress from universe to universe, because since we've had infinitudinous universes, every universe would always be infinitely evolved, if you can follow that. Because every universe, even a Googleplexian ago, of you agos, universes ago, has been preceded by infinitude. And so every universe, by definition, is infinitely involved, infinitely evolved. And even what is the meaning of that? Anyway, we know it is not infinitely evolved, that it's simply a singularity, a one, infinitely distanced from the infinity of infinities. So I don't look to evolution between universes, from universe to universe. I look for the completion of the creative project of any universe, and then the reemergence of yet another with another creative theme. That man, as usual, distorted and misinterpreted the teaching and the truth. And that it fell, as does all else at present, under the glamour and illusion of the astral plane. Thus inverting it towards egoism, lower egoism, not higher ego, plus the Piscean influence is true. Man's thought dominated and distorted the ideal and produced, and this is rare for the Tibetan, such a damnable doctrine as the elect of God, the chosen of the Lord, or the soul people to benefit by the sacrifice and death of the great Son of God. He's weighing in here against Calvinism with the idea that Almighty God determined from the beginning, Almighty and all-merciful God, determined from the beginning who would be damned to hell forever and who would be saved. So you really can't help it, and anything that you do cannot fight against this pre-selection of who are the elect and who are not. It's such an incredibly separative doctrine. You can understand that it's operating under the law of cleavages. I do believe Calvin had a lot of fifth ray in his mind. He just said that this was logically necessary with an almighty, all-foreseeing God. But, of course, the immanence of God is not understood by the traditional churchman. So man's thought dominated and distorted the ideal and produced such a damnable doctrine as the elect of God, the chosen of the Lord, as if God could possibly be so separative, and as if we were not actually aspects of God itself, or the soul people to benefit by the sacrifice and death of a great Son of God, 144,000. It's not very much in a world of a billion Christians, is it? You know, let's just say that 144,000 only takes in a few of the billion Christians in the world. But DK has given us in TWM the true occult meaning of this so-called number of the saved. Yes, the number of the saved, those who have all petals open, all 144 of them, by his method of counting, plus the three ciphers of the personality. Then we shall have the energy condition within our energy system to lead to at-one-ment with the higher worlds and thus with reabsorption into the immortal states, and thus be saved. And so the few, the soul people, the only people, how separative, incredibly separative, to benefit by the sacrifice and death of the great Son of God, and who pass, due to the merits of that vicarious death, into a state of bliss in heaven simply because of an emotional choice, which ignores millions of those who have made no such choice, nor had the opportunity to do so, nor ever heard of it. You know, some of the more compassionate churchmen have reached out and said, well, look, this doesn't make sense for an all-compassionate God. There are people who have never heard of the choice to be saved and not to be saved, to believe in Jesus Christ and not to. And are they to be damned simply because they've never heard about it? Well, some might say, well, this is simply one of the mysteries, you know, God's ways are inscrutable, but, you know, my answer to this is that man's mind is just limited, and that somehow we theologically come up with certain configurations that we force on others, and we believe in the ironclad conclusions of our narrow, limited, one-pointed, set mind, as DK calls it. Narrow, one-pointed, limited, set. The symbolic activity of the great teacher of Nazareth will be properly understood, and its significance will be properly appreciated only when group implications are more carefully studied. Not just, you know, not just salvation of this illusory aggregation we call ourselves, not the salvation of the illusory aggregation of matter we call our self, then will the meaning of sacrifice and death come into their rightful place when the group implications meaning here inclusiveness, will come into their rightful place in human consciousness, and the law of giving, right giving, of course, because it's possible to give too much, you know, right and proportionate giving with true benefit to the recipient, with all that that entails, is correctly understood and applied. Well, okay, friends, as I said, I may have gone on talking here a bit. Sometimes when I pause, I press the stop recording button. I look away and assume that it has done its work. And in fact, either the recording has kept going, so I'm recording a lot of nothing, or I think that I've pressed start recording, and I start talking, and I haven't started at all. And I think that's what happened here. So we'll see. I'm going to, just to try to even things out, say that this will be the end of Laws of the Soul webinar commentary number 2, page 89, EP 289. Great book, really. And so practical for people of our kind. And beginning of Laws of the Soul webinar commentary number 3, beginning on the same page. So, you know, it is, I appreciate the opportunity, realizing it more and more, to really go slowly here. I'm one of those people that tends to talk too fast sometimes, you know, let my elevated mercury get the better of me. My wife always tells me, stop your galloping mind, da-rum, 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 you know, okay. But sometimes, using the second ray, the energy of the sign Cancer, I like to just sit with things and slowly associate ideas which may be related in an illuminative manner. And then much more will come for us. As I say, I think I read this book for the first time 42 years ago. And I'm still with it, thinking that more and more of light and understanding can be extracted from it with a careful reading. And that's basically what we're doing here together in all of these commentaries. We are carefully reading the books together. Now, you will come up with your own ideas, of course, but I'm hoping that some of what I say here will be supplementary to what you might think and will be enriching of your thought process. That would be my hope. And time will tell whether that is the case. Okay, so we'll go on then to Laws of the Soul webinar commentary number 3 in Esoteric Psychology 2, page 89. We'll see you as shortly as possible.